Welcome to Rock and Roll Shinsu Chew. Tonight's episode is episode 125. And somewhere between Poison winding down and Pearl Jam winding up, several American bands with influences from the Grateful Dead, the Allman Brothers, Little Feat, and in certain cases, the Talking Heads and the Residents, achieved national stardom. After the making the rounds on the Eastern and Southern college circuits, bands like Vermont's Fish and Athens, Georgia's Widespread Panic and Princeton, New Jersey's Blues Traveler started drawing sizable audiences and even experienced some chart success. This was an important time for all of us, and we all lived through this, and we're ready to discuss the good, the bad, and the string cheese. This is Rock and Roll Shinsu Chew, episode 125, 90s Jam Bands. And my name is Gabe Estill, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Dennis Levi Leach and Jonathan Getz. How are you guys?
Good.
You may notice that we have a special guest tonight, and this is an extra special guest for me. I'd like to welcome my butter half, Stephanie Hillwack. How are you, Steph?
Hi, guys. How are you?
Hey. So, all right. Nice to see you, hear you.
I've been preparing for this my whole life, so I could not believe it when I got the call.
You're like, okay, 124 episodes. What's going on now.
124 episodes in the minors, and you got the call up.
I know, so. Exactly. I've been hearing him record this podcast for 12 years in my house, and finally, yeah. he asked me to join him.
Well, awesome. welcome to esteemed company, Steph. So anyway, tonight, like I mentioned, is episode 125. We're focused on 90s jam bands. And I think this was really, we're talking about a period that all four of us lived through, right? We're all roughly about the same age. And I speak for all of us when I say, like, 1995 to like 2000, this shit was really important to us. I mean, it still is, yeah, to a degree.
It still is.
If you guys looked, it still is. Like, if you looked at like a pie chart of our household expenses, like 30% is fish. All right. So Steph tonight is going to talk
about. And we are talking about Branzino.
Right. Steph tonight is kind of going to be our resident fish expert. Obviously, we think of them as sort of the, part of the cream of the crop of bands that
the
jam.
Dover soul of fish.
Yeah. That's right. Absolutely. So we chose this episode because it's important to us. Also, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about kind of what is a jam band a little bit as well. So, I mean, do you guys want to take a stab at that first, and then we'll get to Steph's the kind of the fish Q&A with Steph. Like, how do you define a jam band? Somebody's like, I don't know what a jam band is.
Well, I guess my criteria would be improvisation is probably got to be in the forefront. It doesn't necessarily always have to be like super long jams.
Right.
I've seen some jam bands that, you know, not every song was like 8-10 minutes or whatever.
Right. Right.
So like, yeah, I would say improv is my biggest probably requirement.
I would agree with that as well. I think you factor in the importance of changing set list every night or about every night. I think that's, well, I mean, that, I guess that kind of comes with improv. Jonathan, go ahead though, man.
Well, no, yeah, I would agree.
I think, too, you do have to talk about the style of music being played, because in many ways, you know, Metallica could fit a lot of these criteria, but it's metal. So, like, you wouldn't think of Metallica as a jam band. And so the idea of, like, roots-based rock and roll, bluegrass and blues, and then because then you start talking about, like, and jazz. Yeah, absolutely. Because then, you know, halfway through our preparation for this episode, you know, I realized that we hadn't been talking about, say, like Government Mule. And I started to wonder, like, do these guys consider Government Mule a jam band? So, like, just the idea that we, like, have these conversations, it makes it interesting because, these definitions can be kind of fluid. I think genre does have a lot to do with it because the Mule was kind of on the edge of that genre at times.
Yeah. And I think, you know, groundwork laid by some classic rock bands that jammed. Obviously, I mentioned in the intro, Grateful Dead, Allman Brothers, Little Feat. I would say those would kind of be like Traffic, maybe, you know, I would say those would be some of the main influences of all of these bands. You know, I've seen all of these bands cover those bands multiple times over. But so we'll start here because I want to be mindful of Steph's time. Steph, we're going to talk about how you got into the drug band.
Okay. Yeah, definitely.
So we all know that around 1995, the members of Phish murdered Jerry Garcia. Right? Everybody knows that, right? Yeah. And this is breaking. I didn't know this prior to the episode, okay? But I guess everybody knows it. I always thought Mike Gordon looked kind of shifty anyway. All right. So conveniently for them, Jerry Garcia dies and Phish starts to really blow up. 1995, that's around when they, you know, they become pretty much entirely an arena band at that point. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I'm lining up. I've got a tinfoil hat when it comes to some of this stuff. I think
you've uncovered the biggest conspiracy of our time.
That's right. So Steph, if I'm not mistaken, right, 1995 was your first Phish show.
Certainly was, Gabe.
Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, where was it?
Gather around, where I have a tale to tell. So I, unlike the three of you guys, I grew up on the East Coast. And I always joked that in ninth grade, you received three CDs, Bob Marley's Legend, Dave Matthews Under the Table Dreaming, and Fisher's Junta. And like, that becomes your personality, right? unless the punks get you first, right? Or something like, you know, there aren't that many lanes.
Right.
For East Coast.
Funk, Phish, Pearl Jam. Those are your lanes, yeah. Right? For people our age.
Yeah. For East Coast prep school hippies. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I sort of found, I was really interested in absurd music and music that was funny. And I didn't put this together until I was thinking about this episode, but in fifth and sixth grade, I really fell in love with They Might Be Giants. And I just thought that they were so funny and clever. And I know they're deeply weird and still exist, but I loved sort of the fun they were having with music in a way that I didn't know you could have. I grew up, my parents were huge Springsteen fans. And so like everything felt very earnest, right? Like you played guitar because you wanted to protest things. And my parents also went to see the Grateful Dead quite a few times as well. And so I was vaguely aware of like, other, you know, I grew up in a house with music, but I just finally, when I found They Might Be Giants, I thought like, oh, this is speaking to me, whatever I was, 12 at the time. And from there, someone was like, if you like weird, you should listen to Phish. And I was like, okay. And the weird that Phish is a different weird, obviously, than They Might Be Giants. But that's, it wasn't necessarily the music. It wasn't necessarily the drugs. I was just really young. Still probably going to DARE meetings or whatever. but it was
class,
it was
DARE cool. Class, not DARE meeting.
Yes. Right.
Both came DARE meetings sound like legally mandatory.
I dare you to stop doing drugs. Yes. That's another episode. Yeah. And so I fell in love with the whimsy of it. I fell in love with how silly it was. And I still to this day, you know, the Phish shows that I like best are the ones where they're just really having a lot of fun and they're being really silly. And so 90s Phish to me is, yes, they're reckoning with this new found fame. You know, they're building things into their set list that are kind of like actively trying to push that back, right? You guys may know that in the 90s, they incorporated something they called the language, which are certain musical teases that the audience knew what to do. Mm-hmm. And those like posers or new people who would be there, like wouldn't know what to do. And so it'd be really obvious that like they didn't belong there, which is actually kind of snobby now that I think about it, but it felt like I'm like part of this fun club that like is funny and they play chess with the audience. And it just, that's what got me. And then I think from there, it was really the relationships that I built with friends that I met because of Phish. And still to this day, it's like, that's what it is. And I think most people our age, they're still doing this, probably would say the same, that it's about, you know, the friends we made along the way.
Yeah,
sure.
And then in college, you listened to them even more, yeah. And you had a lip piercing for a little while. And you started to wear a bunch of like corduroy patchy yeah. shit, you know, stuff that was just those. Levi, you remember those, right? The patches.
Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Right. That was my every hippie girl was, had those. Yeah. Yes.
My wardrobe was 90% smocks. Just. No,
what was the earliest time that you got to the parking lot before mm-hmm. the show started?
Wait, in the 90s or like anytime?
Ever.
I mean, I do remember, like, and you said my first show was in 95. I remember deeply, like, the experience of walking onto the lot.
Would have been your senior year of high school, right?
Senior year of high school, mm-hmm. December 15th, 1995, the Philly Spectrum. And just really feeling like you're entering into a different world, right? Like, there's sounds and smells and people, and it's just really to some people like extremely gross and to other people it smells like home. And like there was that moment in time, like I know what I talked about, like I love Phish because of the whimsy, but there's also like some like fear in it. You never know what you're gonna get, right? Mm-hmm. Like what are we in for tonight? And so like there's a certain tension or a certain kind of anxiety that you feel when you go to a show that I find actually like really fun. And I just remember that time, like walking onto my first lot and thinking like, I'm here. Like, this is, I did it, yeah. guys.
These are my people. Yeah.
Yeah. It was her first shakedown. Yeah. It was in Philly at the Spectrum. She ate mushrooms of Jerry Stackhouse that night. All right. It was,
I think he had a triple double basketball reference.
Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, and so I don't know. It felt like kind of a secret society that was open to pretty mm-hmm. much anyone. And if you liked it, you got to stay, and if you didn't like it, you didn't have to stay. And like it was just one of those things that I really did like it. I continued to like it more as time went on.
So that was, has it changed much over the years?
Changed?
Has the scene, like the scene? Yeah, how has the scene changed? Yeah, and how have the shows changed? How's the band changed?
And evolved over that many years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so someone else asked me this. I'm like, I don't know. They take credit cards in the
park. Right.
But it's still very
they're still accepting money. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
you can just get a QR code for the veggie burrito. Now.
Yeah. I actually like did the whole like selling grilled cheeses and beer in the parking lot to fund like getting to the next show in like fall 97 and some other tours. But you know, like the lot is the same. I mean, obviously we all have gray hair now, yeah. And like it's old people.
More of the shakedown has a mortgage now, yeah. You know what I mean?
But like the shows, it's a good question. I mean, in some ways, like they haven't changed a bit, right? Like, I mean, they're still incredibly long. They do play two sets. Mm-hmm. You know, they say they're going to take a 15-minute break for set break, and it's usually closer to 50 minutes.
Never played the same show twice.
Never played the same. Yeah.
They haven't. Like, has this been like studied? Like, not by accident.
I fired that off without looking it up, but it's easy to verify.
Statistically, very, very improbable, given that they have, like,
I mean, maybe like their first few shows, right? Maybe. I think 84 was their first year. So, anyway.
Okay, but I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
I was going to say, Gabe, I can distinctly remember when you got ripped.
Hmm.
And I can remember us listening to it in your bedroom, down in your basement.
Yeah, yeah. Just Levi just chilling on the waterbed, you know.
Thinking
about what it all means, you know. Plane. Yeah, right. Which is my favorite fish, by the way.
I think that's Fish's most Pearl Jam song.
It's their grungy song. Horn is kind of Fish's grungy song. Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway.
Okay.
Yeah.
But to answer your question, Jonathan, I mean, like, what's interesting is that I went to Big Cypress, which was the concert at the turn of the millennium. It was on a reservation in South Florida along Alligator Alley. And that was a massive undertaking, right? We were stuck in a traffic jam for like 15 hours or something like that. And jeez, that whole thing was two shows, right? I mean, mm-hmm, technically the midnight set was like 8 hours long. Right. but that was like two shows. Jeez. And now it's pretty routine for there to be like a four show mm-hmm festival or a four show run for a weekend. And so it's like some of these like big moments in time. Big Cypress, Coventry in 2003, which was their last show, air quotes, was only two shows. And so, like, I think that it's gotten bigger.
Yeah.
It's gotten more sort of like mini residencies, and the festivals themselves have gotten much bigger.
Probably a little easier for the band with their age, too. I would guess to play like three, four nights at a venue as opposed to one night each city, you know?
Yeah. And obviously, the music has changed, right? They've written new songs. They've written quite a few new songs. And I would say that, like, I went through a period, I know we're talking about 90s, but I'll just say this really quickly.
No, it's okay.
I'll say, like, there was a period when I was like a really bad Fish fan. I was like, you know, like, no new crap. Like, just play the hits.
Right.
Oh, so you were insufferable.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
The many hits.
Right. I mean, I was just walking down the street today and like I bumped into a half a dozen people singing Punch You in the Eye. Right. You know, I mean, yeah.
No, but like, there had to be this moment where I was like, do I still like this band? Because like they aren't playing the same songs that they played in 1985. And it was like, there was a couple of years where I was, I think, a bad fan. And then it was clicked for me, and it's like they have to write this new song so that they enjoy playing and so that I can continue going. And so that was a real turning point for me. But anyway, 90s Fish.
Yeah. I'll thank you, honey. Well articulated, as always. I'll add one thing, I think, too, that's changed. You know, I mean, my first show was in 98, so she's got a few years and a couple hundred shows on me. But I think one thing that changes, it's less college centric. You know what I mean? Like, you don't, I mean, there, of course, will always be a segment of the college going population that likes Fish and Widespread Panic and the Grateful Dead and blah, blah, blah. But that's changed. I mean, you know, when all of us were like, you know, in high school or like in the late 90s, right, they would always play Champagne, you know, they played Ames, Iowa, they played Madison, you know, I mean, like, and then obviously even before that, all the shows up and down the East Coast, all the colleges, excuse me, up and down the East Coast. You know, you look at, I think it's fun to look at old tour dates and you see, you know, Fish playing like Colby College and, you know, like some small liberal arts college in the Northeast, which I think would have been cool to see all that. But yeah, it's less of a college going crowd than it used to be. And the tour isn't centered around college towns as much as it once was.
Yeah, that's a funny point. Whenever I see someone who's like college age at a Fish show, I'm like, excuse me, are you lost?
Right.
Like, why did your parents bring you? Like, what are you doing here? Like, how?
Well, speaking of, are you seeing kids at Fish shows, or are people bringing their kids?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, there are young people who are finding it too. I mean, in the same way that like we found it, there's nothing necessarily very territorial about like us having been there first. If you love it, you love it. And everyone has sort of a different reason for being there. And if you're, you know, not talking real loud during the jams and like, you know, there's really not that many rules for entry. Just like have a good time and don't be an asshole.
Right. Which is what we wanted every year, really.
And try to keep dancing like within the confines of respecting those around you.
Yeah.
Sure. Right. Oh, sometimes the jams are just so good.
You just hits too hard.
Spread those arms. Noodle dance into the night.
Yeah.
Mosh pit at Fish.
Just a little bit of the Fish lexicon for those who might be listening who aren't as familiar. If Steph says 1.0, right, that means Fish up until, from their start up until the year 2000. Mm-hmm. Okay. Why is that? Because they took a hiatus in 2000.
They sure did.
Yes, yes, they did. And then
2.0.
They started back late 02. Yeah, and then that went to 04, where they took another hiatus, which everybody kind of thought was going to be the very end.
Sorry,
yeah.
Coventry was in 2003.
Yeah. It was in 2004. Sorry. It was in 2004, Coventry. It was a big muddy festival that her and I went to.
Terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, it wasn't that
funeral.
It was bad. It wasn't that great. And then they got back together 5 years later. Mm-hmm. And you know, Trey, you know, went through their lead singer, guitarist, really rough period, you know, during that time. Mm-hmm. And it's really been great. It's been really nice to see him come out on the other side of that. And mm-hmm. he's very open about it, and you know, that's been nice. So 3.0 started in 2009 and
went to the pandemic,
and then I don't know, she gets granular like this. I guess 4.0 is the pandemic to now.
These are facts, people. Okay. Just like right.
I just think this is just
I've never heard that referred to with any other band. What are Fish song songs about? Generally, I've heard many of the songs.
Jonathan's like, I'm not really about following this lizard's llama pattern that they've got going on here.
It's like a psychedelic mac and cheese thing.
Yeah. Well,
and then I just mean like generally speaking. Like,
yeah.
What's the general topics that they're
well,
covering?
I mean, I think in the same ways that you can like break down Fish into like certain, you know, eras, 1.0, whatever.
Yeah.
There's different like strains of Fish tunes. So another one of the reasons I love Fish very much is it has its own fairy tale, right? Trey, his senior thesis in college was called The Man Who Stepped Into Yesterday, which most Fish fans know as the story of Gamehenge. And it's literally a fairy tale, a very traditional hero seeking to understand and to overcome, troubles, evil, to good over evil, in the land of Gamehenge. And it's really fucking dorky. I mean, it is like real dorky. And I love it. I love it. It just,
no, it's great. That's great.
Tickles me. So, you know, there's like the Gamehenge songs, which mean a lot to a lot of people. There are the absurd songs that mean a lot to a lot of people that are nothing. And then I think more recently, Fish has been, especially Trey, has been writing a lot of like what we call like love and light Trey. Like he's just so freaking happy. Like, and thank God for that, right? Because he was still, actively using, we wouldn't be still seeing Fish.
Right.
And so there's a lot of like really kind of silly, happy songs that are very like Trey love and light. And there's some joy to them as well. So I wouldn't say there's any one thing that makes a Fish song per se. Someone would say probably one that can last 40 minutes. Like that's a Fish song, but
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, like they still play songs that they played in, you know, like the 80s and early 90s, like regularly in their sets. So, I mean, there's a lot of different.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sure. But no, that's helpful to better understand. Yeah. Yeah.
There's just good. A general quirkiness, you know, too. I mean, sure. Like they teach.
I would say that.
And like they play interesting covers. Go ahead, Levi.
I was going to say, I fully agree. And I don't know if it's necessarily just limited to Fish, like. The East Coast jam bands like Spin Doctors, Blues Traveler, God Street Wine, and Fish all have kind of a quirkiness to them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's kind of a regionalism type of a thing.
It's all kind of bouncy too, you know? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You probably want to talk about some of those other 90s.
We will. So let's just fire these off real quickly. All right.
Yeah.
How many shows have you been to, Fish shows, Deeps?
Well, the records are a little spotty, guys, but best I can tell, 201.
All right. Now we're talking.
Lastly, we'll make this, since we do have a small baseball piece to this show. You've broken the glass ceiling. You're in the first woman in Major League Baseball. What's your Fish walk-up song?
That's going to be a Twee Prize, Gabe.
All right. I knew it.
That's going to be a Twee Prize. So.
Like to thank Steph for coming in tonight.
I'm sorry. What was it again?
Little Jonathan. There's a song called Tweezer, and then they play a version of Tweezer that's called Tweezer. Okay. Reprise, but we call it Reprise. And then together, it's Tweeprise.
The Tweeprise.
Okay, that's what I was getting at. I just wanted the translation for our novice listeners.
I probably gave you a tape, Jonathan, a Maxell XL2. Say like Encore, Tweeprise, something like that.
Yeah. Tweeprise.
Yeah.
Well, but I mean, you guys, I will leave so you guys can talk about other things in baseball. But, you asked like what makes a jam band. I think there's some degree of like, each having its own vocabulary, each having its own sort of quirks, right? Like, all of what we're talking about right now is very like insider knowledge that if you're really into a particular band, it's lore, if you will. I'm sure that there's probably those things with other bands as well, but just there's something about, I think, the fanaticism of the fans and also sort of the prolificness of the artists that really, give to this space where there's just languages that are created and idioms and puns and all of those things. And it's like, Fish, John Fishman, the drummer from Fish, wears a dress while he plays, and it has the classic one is blue with red donuts on it. And you'll see people wearing just red donuts on things or on their car and their case or whatever. And it's like, I was during the pandemic, I remember I was with my brother and I was wearing a Fish mask and like happened to walk by someone in the street and we just clocked each other and it was like, hey man, like see you on the road. and my brother was like, dude, you're in a gang. like those are gang symbols. And I'm like, it's a pretty cool gang. but we have our own art, that sort of stuff. And so there's that sense of it being like a little bit of a contained universe.
Yeah, that's great.
Well, yeah, it's a community.
You couldn't ask for anything more.
Yeah. I mean, I don't belong to any church, but I do, I do believe in.
But you have a tribe. Yep.
I do. Thank you guys so much. Have so much fun talking about other jam bands.
Well, good talk.
Boogie on, reggae woman.
Bye.
Thanks, Stephanie. All right. So, Gabe, how many times have you seen Fish?
I think my count's pretty accurate because I can, setlist.fm tells me 71.
Okay. All right. Yes. Levi?
Honestly, I think I've seen Fish zero times. And I think I have seen Trey solo at Bonnaroo once, if not twice, maybe.
Okay. Yeah. I've seen Fish three times.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And for all I know, Stephanie sold me the burrito in Madison.
Right.
Gabe reports now.
He looked at him, she's like, hey, I hope you're not doing anything for like the next 10 hours. All right. I don't know what I put in that burrito.
Yeah. Now if you get a garlic cheese, the seller gives you one of those like red paper things. So you're like, okay, I'll wait for my sandwich.
You know what? I'll say, we were talking with Steph about, how the scene has changed. I'll give you one more. Like when I was in the lot in the 90s, everybody was drinking like Samuel Smith's oatmeal stout, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
Nutty brown something or other.
Yeah. Right? Which is completely refreshing on like a 94 degree day.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Especially when you're covered in water.
I want a beer that tastes like a fucking milkshake. Yeah. Awesome.
Gross.
So now the shift is like you see a bunch of White Claws in the parking lot. So
they're like, everybody's a little more carb conscious. Clean waters. Yep.
Yeah. Tastes great, less filling. Yep.
Yes, absolutely. So that's we appreciate Steph coming on the show, and it was good to hear her insights talk about Fish. Yeah.
I think that, Fish is, can be a hot button topic for a lot of people when they think about jam bands. Like they can be maybe divisive for people that just the uninitiated. And I think it sells the genre short on the whole to think, oh, you're into jam bands, so you know, I have a good idea of the music you listen to. It's like, well, you don't, because there are other jam bands. I guess that as a segue into the other jam bands.
Yeah.
Well, let's do it.
And do you guys want to like go maybe through like a regional type of thing to kind of kick it off?
Yeah, we can do it. We can kind of span the map.
Well, yeah. I was going to say, let's start in the East Coast, Northeast.
Yeah.
You know,
and those we already talked about Fish coming out of. And also, we didn't mention earlier, Fish came out of Burlington, Vermont, right? Maybe I mentioned that, right? So all guys that met it at UVM, right? And you know, in the 80s, and the rest is history. Levi, we got Fish off the list here.
And then, so from that area, you could also say would be included would be like Dave Matthews Band was kind of East Coast.
Charleston.
You could like Virginia, East South.
That's not far from the Eastern Seaboard, though. It's in Charleston.
With Blues Traveler and then Spin Doctors and God Street Wine, they were all New York.
Well, Jersey guys, right?
Yeah.
I think.
New York, New Jersey. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. And also, I think one thing we have to mention, thank you, Levi, for bringing up the rest of the East Coast. There was I think this is an important kind of milestone too in 90s jam band. There's a musical venue called Wetlands Preserve that opens in New York City in 1989. And that really becomes just a mainstay of that scene up until it closes. I think it closed in like the early 2000s. That place, you know, that was really important. I mean, like that was the New York City spot to go and, you know, all those bands that we've already discussed played there.
Yeah, opened and, in 89 in Tribeca.
Peter Shapiro, I think, is the guy, right, that was kind of behind the venue. Yeah, go ahead.
It was like eco-activist roots kind of founded.
Right.
And like we said, Fish, Blues Traveler, God Street Wine, Spin Doctors, all those bands like kind of cut their teeth at that place.
Yep, absolutely. And then, yeah, like Levi said, Dave Matt, you know, you let's go south now a little bit, right? You dip down and you've got in Charlottesville, Virginia, another big college town. You've got Dave Matthews emerging in the early 90s as well. You know, there's a connection between him and all those bands that Levi mentioned. Either they jam together or they're kind of running the same circuits, you know, up and down the East Coast, a lot of college towns. And then, you know, we go south and want to talk about another college town, right? You know, Athens, Georgia, which a few years earlier, you know, had produced, you know, one of the best rock bands of all time in REM, you know, and kind of from REM, you know, that comes, you know, same town, a little bit later, Widespread Panic emerges. In the mid 80s, right? Right around the same time as Fish, right? I think Panic's first show's around 84, 85, something like that, maybe.
Yes,
and around there. Maybe
something like that, yeah.
Yeah. And I know that I speak for all three of us when, you know, we obviously had a lot of affection and still do, you know, for Widespread. You know, such a great band, important band. And, I mean, you've also got, coming from, Georgia as well. I think, is there anybody else down there?
It would behoove us to mention the Allman Brothers because at that time,
sure,
they were considered like elder statesmen of the jam band scene.
Yeah.
Because they had like morphed themselves through the early 80s and came out of the late 80s as like, paired with the Grateful Dead, really. It was like in the late 80s, you went to the Grateful Dead and you went to the Allman Brothers, that crowd. You know what I mean? They were going to those.
If you weren't into like, you know, Debbie Gibson or the Bullet Boys or something, you went that route, right? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
In their resurrection, rejuvenation, the Allman Brothers was because of, you know, two young guys who joined the band in the late 80s and Warren Haynes and Alan Woody. And then they go on to form a, you know, a side project, essentially, that is Government Mule. That's, you know, one of the most successful and long-lasting jam bands of all time.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, those guys really important for the resurrection of the Allman Brothers. And, you know, strangely enough, even though the Grateful Dead is, you know, we so closely associated with the Bay Area, most of the jam scene of the 90s that we're discussing tonight really had origins further east. You know, I mean, right? I mean, I'm sure there are a few California kind of jam-like bands, you know, but really, you know, not as prominent as it was on the East Coast.
That's a good point.
I mean, yeah. as far as West Coast, you would almost kind of stop at the mountains. You know what I mean? Like leftover salmon and string cheese in Colorado. Sure.
Yeah, Colorado. Yeah, obviously a big scene
and
there.
So like, bluegrass. Further ends. West than that, yeah, it's kind of hard to name some. I mean, if we leave the South, though, immediately and then, you know, turn to the West and go up some, we get to the Midwest, though, which is like kind of the home of the bread and butter of some of the bands like Umphrey's McGee, Moe. Even though Moe is from like upstate New York, they literally like lived and survived and made their careers on the Midwest touring. If you like look back at all of their, like that's how they made themselves. And so I always kind of considered Moe a Midwest band.
Yeah. And, yeah, and you mentioned Humphreys McGee as well. You know, they're from South Bend, Indiana, and they were guys that were influenced by Fish, you know, and Moe. So you see like some younger bands kind of like start to be influenced by those bands that we just mentioned. You know, Humphreys being one of those younger bands that was kind of really starting to emerge in the late 90s.
Yeah, and the Big Woo would play Chicago a lot, and I want to say they were from Minnesota.
They're from the Twin Cities, I believe. Yeah.
So the Midwest, like, it's weird. Like, if you kind of describe those scenes, like, with, like, as far as musical traits, it would be like the Midwest had more, like, heavier guitar tones, kind of more of a prog influence. You know, like, less of a scene hype and more of, like, road miles. And then the South is like blues roots, and like the jams had like patient builds and like the emotional communal feel of like early Allman, like White's Road Panic with Hauser, and then the Allman Brothers of the late 80s, early 90s. And it was all about outdoor amphitheaters in the South. And then
you get Capricorn Records playing kind of a part and some of promoting some of that too.
Yeah. You know, yeah. And then when you go up to the East Coast where Fish and all those bands were, they were more like compositionally complex more. There was a little more jazz school chops, like more playful, quirky energy, you know, the Wetlands, the Paradise, their whole circuit that they had. Like tape culture was really strong on the East Coast.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's neat that each region kind of, like, did their own thing within the greater jam band scene.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and yeah, you mentioned, like, it is very regional, you know what I mean? It's for a little while, and then I would say around 1995, and again, I was joking about this at the beginning, obviously, Jerry Garcia passes away, you know, in 1995, and that's really right around the time that some of those audiences, and I don't think that's the only reason. I mean, Fish was still had some overlap with the Grateful Dead, and Fish was at least on the East Coast drawing bigger audiences, but really they didn't become like kind of an arena band, like playing places like, you know, the arena in Champaign, and they played Tinley Park, and they, you know, they didn't become an arena band really until about 95. You know, that's when, you know, there's no more theaters, you know, it's big time at that point. You know, they're playing amphitheater, the summer amphitheaters, and, you know, the all, you know, a lot of college basketball arenas. So, you know, I think that's one thing that happens. Fish, you know, that's a big marker in the turn is Fish becomes, you know, more than a regional act, a bigger act, right? And you start to see Panic do that as well. You know, Panic in the 90s. you know, they play in some smaller venues, then all of a sudden, hey, they start selling out the Fox Theater in Atlanta, right? Sometimes, you know, a few nights at a time. And then that becomes a big thing. The next thing you know, into the century, Panic is headlining the Hawks Arena, like playing the Omni, you know, yeah. and the Phillips Arena. So, you know, that I think that graduation of Phish and Panic and Blues Traveler, you know, Blues Traveler selling out Madison Square Garden in like 95, you know, 96.
Mm-hmm. So like props to the Spin Doctors. Yeah. They were maybe the first million-dollar jam band. You know what I mean?
Right. Then the Blues Traveler. You know, those are the two that have the chart success, right? I mean, Dave Matthews too. But
But all of these bands started in the 80s, and people forget that, and especially people on the outside don't realize that. You know,
right.
like Panic and Phish are from the mid 80s, right?
Yeah.
Right. Blues Traveler's debut was 89. Mm-hmm. They've been cutting their teeth for a while to get to these arenas.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, shit, they. You're playing hundreds of shows a year.
Yeah.
I mean, there were probably some. There's probably sleeping on a lot of couches, you know, and all those other things that bands do. And it is fascinating that other than Blues Traveler, the Spin Doctors, and I would say that, like, unfortunately, success probably cursed those two ultimately, right? I mean, you know, I don't mean to disrespect these guys. Hey, we all got to make a living, but like. Both those are kind of like the casino rib fest circuit now, you know, and just unfortunately that's just how it's changed now. You know, the success
in hindsight,
commercial success can hurt them often.
Yeah.
What's that?
I was going to say in hindsight, like the chart sales and the sales, shot their street cred with the fans that made them originally popular.
Panic and Phish never had that. Panic and Phish are still playing arenas in 2025, 2026, you know.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, and, but it blows my mind that Space Wrangler and the Super Bowl Shuffle were recorded around the same time.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm just going to go over, guys, we're going to get into some of our favorite albums and shows that we saw during this era. You know, but just a couple other kind of big things that happened in kind of 90s jam band history. We mentioned Wetlands opening. We mentioned Phish growing its audience and graduating to arenas around the middle of the decade of the 90s. Also, another thing that emerges really is, you know, you look at Lollapalooza that was going on in the early 90s. They were when they were touring it, when it wasn't just in Chicago, you know, when you had bands like Jane's Addiction and Pearl Jam and you know, and Smashing Pumpkins and Soundgarden, whoever else playing it. Blues Traveler kind of took that and made it sort of a jam band version of it in the Horde Festival, which ran for about 6-7 years in the 90s. And really what it did was it took all of those bands, because Phish played Horde, right, in 92. Panic played Horde. Government Mule played Horde a little bit later, you know. What Horde did was it took all of those bands and put them into the summer amphitheaters, and you know they got more exposure that way as well. You know,
and then they all started being able to sell the amphitheaters by themselves.
Absolutely, years after Horde, Phish is playing those same venues and headlining them. You know, right. I mean, Blues Traveler as well. So I think the Horde Festival is really neat. And there was just, you know, look at the Horde lineups. There were some great, great bills. Jonathan, you saw one of them. You went to 95.
Yeah, August 95 was my jam band baptism, and that was Horde with Traveler, Crows, Dave Matthews, and the Almonds.
Yeah,
oh, absolutely, been
Jesus. Yeah, damn. Yeah, that's wild, dude. And then you know a lot of other. They had some veteran acts, like, you know, you mentioned the Allman Brothers. I want to say Neil and Crazy Horse headlined Horde one year as well, I believe. 97, I think.
97,
yeah. So it was definitely, you know, jam and some of the sort of elder statesmen of the jam scene as well, headlining Horde. So I think, you know, Horde's a big event. You know, also, I think we talked about Widespread Panic and, you know, Widespread Panic in 1998 plays a show in their hometown of Athens, Georgia, right? You know, Panic in the Streets. I mean, 100,000 people show up to watch that show, right? I mean, like, you got everybody there from, like, the heads in the parking lot to, like, the lady at the bank, the bank teller, showing up to see Panic, right? I mean, that's huge. 100 fucking thousand people, you know, watch Panic in 98. I mean, that's just wild, you know, right? I mean, even if it's in your hometown, right? I mean, that's nuts.
Yeah.
And it had to have been something to be there. If you were there, I'm certainly envious. It was a killer show too. Yeah. So I think that one, you know, that just, you know, ability to draw 100,000 people, you know, to a free show in your hometown. You know, also I think Steph kind of hinted at this a little bit when she talked about Big Cypress, but if you go back a little bit before that, Phish had started putting on some of their own festivals, right? Like Lemon Wheel and, you know, things like that. And I think that kind of gave birth to, you know, it wasn't Horde Fest. There weren't multiple bands on it, but like these bands kind of having their own festivals, right? I think Phish kind of were some of the early people to start that trend as well. And then also, you know, I think another thing that keeps the momentum going, Jerry Garcia, while he dies in 1995, the remaining members of the band pick up almost immediately in side projects, right? Rat Dog, you know, the other ones. Then it becomes the Further Festival, you know, which kind of picks up where Horde leaves off, sort of, you know, but it's obviously anchored by members of the Grateful Dead. So, yeah, I think those things, I mean, anything else I'm forgetting, guys, that like kind of like the big 90s kind of things that happened in the scene?
We went to the festival, what was the Mo festival called in Chillicothe?
That was like Summer Sessions, I believe.
Summer Sessions, yeah, with Mo and Mule and String Cheese, yeah.
Okay. Summer Camp.
Summer Camp.
I mean, the idea that you could essentially like take back roads to this show in Central Illinois, it blew our minds.
Right,
because usually you have to drive to Chicago or St. Louis or Champaign, but this was in Chillicothe, Illinois. It was great.
Yeah, Long Live Summer Camp.
Yeah,
it's gone.
Yeah, and that was the first year. I mean, like I think it was like they stopped there because they were touring it. Like it was a few dates that year, and then that stuck around, and then Mo and Humphrey still have this summer camp thing going today.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So pretty cool. Pretty, pretty cool. So yeah, those are kind of some of the, you know, the hallmarks of the era.
Yeah, you want to talk about our favorite albums?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, you want to go first?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, often, you know, people in this scene love live music, obviously, right? And I'll praise it as this, guys, before I get my selections. You know, the jam band can be a divisive term. You know, sometimes it kind of carries a stigma to it. You don't always see like the artists kind of embracing it, you know, even if they get lumped into that category. But say what you will about it, and I've certainly been cynical about it sometimes and also kind of in love with it at others. It's an audience that really values the live experience, you know, right? So oftentimes the studio work and the songwriting, you know, people don't always consider those things. You know, they think about, you know, some sick live show. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the studio works, because to me, like, those were important. And those are like some of the first things I've heard of these bands, right? Like Levi had mentioned, I got Rift and then I got a Hoist, you know, like in mid 90s. And, you know, that was the first place I heard Phish. It wasn't actually like a live show.
Or it may have actually been Hoist, I'm thinking.
It might have been Hoist.
That's the one with the horse?
Yeah, right. I had them both. But yeah, I think I got Hoist, actually. Even though Riff came out before Hoist, I think I got Hoist first. Anyway. So what about for you guys? I mean, I've got a couple here that I really like. Like Hoist being one of them. That was kind of where I first heard Phish. I think No Doy by Mo.
So that album,
I forgot how good that one was.
Yeah,
that's one of my favorites. And then there's another one by a lesser known jam band, actually also out of Vermont, that I've always found to be a really ear friendly listen, and it's kind of, I would almost call it folk pop. Strange Folks, Weightless in Water. I think is a really solid record from 1998. It's very friendly. It's very bouncy. I've always just found it really enjoyable. And like, I think the songs are well written. So those are mine, you know, kind of like Hoist, No Doy, and Strange Folks, Weightless in Water, I think would be probably my three favorite studio LPs by these bands.
Nice. Yeah. I'm also a kind of a studio album apologist when it comes to jam bands, Gabe, to your point about, you know, the difference. And I think that, admittedly, I kind of, in many ways, I prefer a lot of the studio stuff, whether it be Widespread's Till the Medicine Takes or Blues Traveler's Straight On Till Morning, Government Mule's Dose, Moe's Tin Cans and Car Tires. Admittedly, I feel guilty about it, but sometimes like, man, if I want to listen to Panic, I'll probably go pick out a studio album to listen to. Mm-hmm. And it's funny how you feel guilty about that as a jam band fan.
Yeah.
An aficionado.
They write good songs though, you know?
I think like some studio efforts are better than others. I think I feel like what Panic was able to achieve with Till the Medicine Takes and Mo with Tin Cans and Car Tires, those two in particular, is remarkable. And if they never played any live shows on those albums, I would still like champion those albums.
A good record's a good record. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Those hold up as their own. Not
if you
just,
guys have to pick those away from the scene or within it.
I
was going to say, I would have picked those albums if you guys hadn't already. Those are stellar albums. It was just weird in hindsight, after I made my list, only one of mine was a studio album.
Oh yeah.
And I didn't do that on purpose. It just, these were like the first four albums that came to my head. The first was Galactic's live album called We Love Them Tonight, live at Tipitina's, and it's from 2001. Mm-hmm. And it was recorded at Tipitina's, which is already like holy ground in New Orleans. You know, the home of Professor Longhair and everything. And so, you know, they're one of those bands that some people are like, oh, that's a jam band. But like, it's not necessarily like exploratory psychedelic-y. It's more like tight groove, heavy funk. Like the rhythm group gets together in this groove and locks, and you just get lost in that groove. Type of a thing.
Yeah.
And the next album was Blues Travelers Live from the Fall. I wore that CD out back in the day. Was it like 96, 97 that it came out? It's just like peak Blues Traveler. Bobby was still in the band, and you learn how great live how Popper was, because some of his like harmonica gymnastics didn't always get on some of those studio albums, and you hear some of just like the rapid fire percussiveness stuff he could do with his harp. And so then my third album was Widespread's Light Fuse Get Away, which it's not Panic in the Streets, but somehow that's related to that album, right? There's like a story between those two albums. I'm not sure.
They're both from 98 recordings, right? I mean,
right.
Yeah.
Well, so it was Light Fuse Get Away came out in 98, but it was recorded in 97, I believe.
And I thought Light Fuse Get Away was Panic in the Street.
That's what I thought too.
Is it? Okay. Is that the same album? So,
I think
what's funny is I have Light Fuse Get Away on CD. Then I also have this other album, I think, called Panic in the Streets.
Levi's right. Light Fuse Get Away was recorded in 97. It's from different 97 shows.
Okay.
But it was, I want to say that the CD release party is basically Panic in the Streets. And that's why I heard those people showed up.
That's why, like, and the covers almost are identical.
Yeah.
And so okay. I had these two CDs and I always kept them because I was like, oh, they're different.
Yep.
Okay.
So hell of a got CD it. Release party, guys. Good going.
Oh my God. Yeah. Can you imagine?
Great.
You know, and that album just shows how good they were at building and just like being patient and like they could just build a groove and build a song until it like explodes.
It's like a big wave, dude, their sound.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Just like keep growing and growing and then it crashes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so my last album was a studio album. And it was God Street Wine's Bag from 1992, mm-hmm. which is kind of earlier in the scene's timeline. And like that album, though, is still kind of foundational if you ask a lot of people that were into jam bands in the East Coast of that time.
Yeah.
New York scenes, the West area, and it was about like the songwriting. That album has a lot of piano presence on it, which is kind of different from a lot of the guitar driven albums of their contemporaries in the jam band scene of that time. Mm-hmm. So I highly recommend everybody check that one out too.
Yeah, absolutely. Uh-huh. Lo Faber's a good songwriter, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think like the songwriters, you know, like of kind of the singer-songwriter like him, and I mentioned Strange Folk earlier, Reed Gnorr from Strange Folk, I think is a really good songwriter. I actually, Jonathan, I think you and I have talked about this too. I think Popper's a really good lyricist. I think he's smart. I think he's clever. Yeah. Obviously, he's been through a lot. Very a break there. Yeah, anyway, go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I was thinking about Popper's songwriting earlier today, and he was, or still is, he would write kind of, it's just more like love or unrequited love songs.
Yeah.
A bit more straightforward in that sense. But at the same time, very clever.
Yeah. And it can be really gut-wrenching. You listen to like Alone, you know? I mean, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's what makes me, in a way, most... Blues Traveler makes me more sentimental than any other jam band.
Yeah.
And that says a lot.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, you know, I've gone through kind of like periods where I've been more invested in all of this scene than I have at other points. And obviously you guys knew me in 1998 and the giant hip necklace I was wearing. And you know,
we all had one. Too,
yeah. Right. I wore Birkenstocks, like unless there was like a heavy snow on the ground, you know, like a light snow, I'll still wear the Birkenstocks. Right. Yeah. You know, I was in college. It was just the height of, you know, I majored in, you know, widespread panic and hacky sack, you know. But yeah, you know, but lately, because I think one of the beautiful things about this podcast, obviously I get to spend it with two of my favorite people, three tonight even. And, you know, it resurrects my affection for previous parts of my life. You know, and, you know, I was kind of like, I've never liked people that kind of had like jam band tunnel vision, you know, and just kind of, you know, were just strictly granola with their taste. And so I think I kind of got cynical about the scene for a while, but in preparing for this episode and just kind of my own listening habits over the last year or so, I've got a newfound appreciation for it. And, you know, hats off to all of these bands. And those that are still kind of out there grinding on it, on that scene. I think it's an audience that really appreciates live music. I think that knows venues really well, you know, and better than a lot of other concert goers do. So yeah, it preparing for this episode got me kind of sentimental, you know, and emotional.
Yeah, especially when you look back at and you're trying to catch up with some of these bands that you don't listen to as much. And it's like, oh, what is Blues Traveler's current lineup? And what is Moe's current lineup? It's the same damn lineup as 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's like, wow, good going, guys. You know, and not to say, you know, we've lost guys along the way, whether, you know, it be Alan Woody or Bobby Sheehan, the bassist Levi mentioned from Blues Traveler. And especially for a genre of music that is, you know, viewed at there's a lot of assumptions about substance abuse that we also joke about. And But at the same time, you know, you get that with any art form, unfortunately. And but I think a lot of these bands, you know, they keep the shit together. And you know, this is it's a well-oiled machine. It's a family. It's a family with that is the touring group that goes beyond the musicians. It's, you know, it's the crew. And then it's also the fans, and to have this kind of lasting power is it says a lot about the character of everybody involved.
Yeah, and it's a graying audience, and when I, you know, because Steph and I obviously still go see Phish quite a bit, and Jonathan, you had mentioned, you know, obviously substance abuse unfortunately has come with the scene, and it's definitely an audience that is loyal and also really likes to party. I will say I've noticed a change. While obviously there's still, you know, Shakedown Street and you can have a good time and everything there.
Sure.
I do think there is a newfound appreciation for the sobriety sector of the scene as well. Mm-hmm. You know, the Grateful Dead had a band of folks called the Wharf Rats that were always to help, to for sober deadheads. Right. And it was a lot of people that were recovering. Phish and Panic and Umphreys, all those bands, they actually have kind of comparable, you know, a similar group to their for their fans. And they at Phish, at least they have a meeting at Set Break, which I think is really cool. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like they get together and it's sort of like a mini AA or NA meeting there, you know, at the show. And I witnessed one of them one time. You know, I still had a beer in my hand, but I saw it and I asked somebody about it, you know, and they told me about it. And it was really touching. It was really, really a cool thing to see. So that's nice. Good to see. Anybody out there struggling with anything like that, I hope you make it out on the other side.
Yeah, I read a Rolling Stone article. You're supposed to like look for a yellow balloon.
Yeah, is that right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And that'll be a key that somebody can help you out, you know, and
that's really cool.
You got somebody to turn to. It's nice. Really cool. It's grown, and the scene's kind of grown in its thoughtfulness, I think, as well.
So. You know, one of the thinking about all the things too that I've appreciated about the scene, which for me it was like 95 to 05 pretty much that I was going to the jam band shows on the regular. I think my favorite part of it all is the idea of seeing a band again the next day.
If you
have the opportunity to see a band more than once, more than one day, so you know maybe they're playing the same city two or three times, to wake up the next day after a show and be like, we get to do it again.
Absolutely.
Like that is so cool.
You, you don't get that with a lot of other bands, you know what I mean? It's one show. Or if it's two shows, you know, it's the same set the next night. You know what I mean? Like,
It is technically the same day?
Yeah,
right. Good
Me
point.
And Gabe, I want to say that first year at Bonnaroo, wasn't it? Didn't we see Mo play till dawn?
Like, yeah, they started at midnight, 7 a.m. I passed out for a little while, woke up, and there was still an hour left. All right.
Come on.
I was passed out in the middle of Bonnaroo.
But like it was the only time I ever seen a band while the sun came up.
Just like a resting Rip Van Winkle on the scene there, you know. Whoa.
But that was wild. Yeah.
That was good. I mean, there's some marathon sessions, man. I tell you what.
I think my jam band peak was June of 2002 at Summerfest in Milwaukee, and I got to see Warren Haynes play for 8 hours. Whoa. I saw him play with Mule at a free stage at Summerfest, and then there was a double bill that night with Phil Lesh and Friends and the Allman Brothers Band, and he played in both of those bands too. And so I, by my calculations, it was 8 hours of Warren in one night.
Man, some people will rag on it. I love that Warren Phil and Friends studio album they did. I forget what it's called.
Only the Strange Remain, is that it? Or no, it's something else.
It almost looks like it's got the Wizard of Oz, like there's a yellow brick road or something.
I gotta look it up. I've never listened to it.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Guys, I wanna a couple other points real quickly. I think I put this in the notes, and I think it's just kind of fascinating to bring up because we haven't talked about these bands necessarily yet. There are kind of some artists that kind of have one foot in that door and one foot out of it. You know what I mean? Like, kind of call them borderline jam acts. I mean, they don't typically always get associated with the scene, but I say this because they've shared some, you know, festival billing with some of these bands, or they've collaborated with members of this scene, or in the a case of a band like Pearl Jam, had a lot of, you know, commercial success, but also, you know, frequently changes its set list and plays longer shows.
Yeah.
And what's that?
They have the traits that we were discussing earlier.
Yeah, you may not see Pearl Jam do like cover Scarlet Begonias or something, but like they've got the traits of the scene, I think. And, you know, some of the bands that I think kind of fit that bill, like Pearl Jam, I would say like Primus. You know, you've got Les Claypool's kind of always been a little bit of like a special guest star in that scene, you know?
Yeah, Flying Frog Brigade stuff.
Yeah. The Ween Brothers, you know, are kind of like have a foot in that. You know, the Black Crowes, you know, kind of, I think, kind of had that arc sort of around from like 95 to like 97, you know, that they headlined Further, headlined Horde, you know, with having commercial success a few years earlier. So they certainly dipped their toes in that. Ben Harper. And I think even some of the bands of today, like Jonathan had mentioned in our notes here, Wilco, you know, has some of that as well. Like I've seen Wilco play with Phil Lesh, you know. My Morning Jacket, I think, has some of that as well. The War on Drugs have some of that. So, yeah, there's always kind of some periphery scene bands, on the periphery of that scene. That's cool to see. And I like it, you know, when those bands become a part of the scene and jam with the other artists. I think it's cool. I think it's just good for everybody, you know?
I do too. And I think that they really spoiled us with these varying set lists to the point where to Steph's point earlier about, you know, having a bit of anxiety about what's going to happen in the show.
Yeah.
Right. Where, you know, back in the day before I was going to see a band, like I would, you would never want to know what the set was going to be. Like you wouldn't even look up the history of the tour, like what they're playing on the tour. But nowadays there are bands, as I listen to a lot more indie stuff and other stuff, that I do actually look up the set to decide if I want to go see that band live to take that anxiety out of the equation.
Right.
And to understand and to be like, I don't care if they're playing the same set every night. I just need to go see them one night and I just need them to be on that night. So it's interesting how your perception shifts depending on what band you're going to see.
Absolutely.
That 2002 Phil and Friends album is called There and Back Again. It was on Columbia. Excuse me. And it's like the band of good guys. So you got Phil, Warren, Jimmy Herring, John Molo on drum kit, and Rob Baracco on keyboards.
I saw that lineup live once or twice. Yeah. It's good. It's a tight band.
The actually had a quasi single. I want to say it's called Night of a Thousand Stars.
Okay. Yeah. I've heard that song. A couple other points, and then we'll put a bow on it, guys. Jonathan and Mitchell Metallica at the beginning of the episode, and that got me thinking, like, what band would you like to see be a jam band for a night, right? Or that you would like to see jam more? Not that they're doing anything wrong right now, but like you just think all the qualities are there for
like
it to happen.
They have to still be alive and going now, like a band that's
Maybe they don't have to. No, they don't have to. They don't have to. I mean, but you took mine, Jonathan. I'm going to say Metallica. Like I want to go see Metallica, and they're just, James comes up to set, he's like, fuck it, we didn't write a set list. It's going to be loose. You know what I mean? Like,
I want a 20-minute To Live Is To Die.
You know, Metallica has some long-ass songs.
To Live Is To Die, yeah,
absolutely. Room the Bell Tolls, man. They're like, Room the Bell Tolls are like 18-minute long live, dude. So, like, I'd love to see them do a night or two of that approach. You know what I mean? Like, I would eat that shit up. Yeah. So
right on. Yeah, it's a good choice. That's a good choice. Yeah.
Like a fantasy band, I guess, would be like, let's bring back Dire Straits. I'd love to see
good choice.
Good call.
I would take that.
That's a good call.
You know, as far as like bands that are still out there and touring, you know, a band that I saw in the last couple of years, two or three, that blew me away for how good they were, how tight they were. And I was like, man, if I saw they were coming around again, I would go see. And it would be neat to see them extend some of the songs, would be the Doobie Brothers. And they're touring with Michael McDonald in the band. And they did actually extend like a song or two, like a little bit, you know, maybe like 6 or 7 minutes instead of 4 or 3.
Yeah.
But everyone in the band, you could tell, is just like pros as far as instruments, as musicians. You know, you could tell of so many years of being together and playing the songs that were so tight. It would just be neat to hear them do just like a 15-minute Another Park, Another Sunday or something.
Oh, yeah. That's not that far-fetched, you know? I mean, for those guys to do that, you know? I mean,
right?
Like, you kind of put the Doobie Brothers in kind of the Little Feat Allman Brothers kind of conversation, you know? Like, they could. I'm with you there. They could pull off. I think the Doobie Brothers are Bay Area guys too, right? I think
you could be
right. Or no. Yeah. I think so, right? I think they are. Yeah, so that's great. I love that. I love that too. Jonathan, what about you, man? Do you have a band you'd really like to see strengthen out that normally doesn't?
Well, a band that is so very close to being that is Sturgill Simpson, a.k.a. Right. Johnny Blue Skies and the Dark Clouds. And Levi and I, and Gabe, you as well. You know, we've had the fortune of seeing them over the last year. And you look at those set lists, and there's a lot of arrows in those set lists.
Oh, yeah.
But granted, you know, it's usually within the confines of, say, you know, a 4-minute, 5-minute song.
He has a famous quote, right, where he says, "We're not a jam band. We're a band that jams."
There's a
fucking difference or something, he says.
It's like,
you know, if we don't want to play 11-minute version, we're not going to or something.
Right. Yeah. But for one night, you know, what if you were a jam band? That's what I want to hear.
100%, man. 100%. Yeah. All right. Lastly, guys, let's do it. Let's do our walk up numbers. We asked Steph earlier, and she went with the Twee prize. You guys got a walk up tune among the bands we've discussed,
and a baseball at bat walk up tune.
Yes, okay. Baseball bat walk up tune. Yes, to put a little bit of a.
I got mine immediately as soon as it.
What you guys,
plane crash, Mo. I gotta go plane crash.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Maybe just the violin opening part. That way, like,
there you go. So
that if they're cool, they know. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's good. Mine is the transition from Widespreads Till the Medicine Takes, the transition from Party at Your Mama's House into Dying Man. Where like the end of Party at Your Mama's House is like that, it's like that turntable beat, and then it busts into the guitar and at the beginning of Dying Man, like the record scratches. Oh god, like da, 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 da. Wah, 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 wah. That's it.
Excellent work, guys. I'm gonna throw a little bit of a curveball with my selection. It's not my at bat, but I come out of the bullpen to it.
Okay.
Ooh, right. So I come out of the bullpen to Thorazine Shuffle. All right.
Oh yes.
I like it. Yeah. Bring the heater.
Cock my head a little bit, you know. Like I kinda, yeah. I'm a bulleted believer, you know. Just right.
Dude, I almost picked that as well, but for my walk-up music. So it's better. It's better as bullpen music. Good call.
Excellent work, guys. Really, really enjoyed this. Appreciate my lovely wife, Stephanie, joining us tonight, too.
Indeed.
125 episodes, guys. You know?
Who would have thunk it?
Yeah, right. Yeah, so hopefully we'll have some more work. we're kind of on a quarterly schedule now. So we're like a scholarly journal that only comes out quarterly.
Earnings reports.
Baseball and music scholarly journal. Levi majored in Jethro Tull and Joe Carter. All right. So yeah, but anyway, this is always fun. I want to tell everybody to go to rockchew.com. You can find this episode as well as all of our others. You can get the link to listen on Apple Music or Spotify. So yeah, please support us and keep listening and tell your friends. That's rockchew.com. You can find us on Instagram at rockinchew.
Apple Music, Spotify.
Yeah. Spotify as well. Yeah, we are on Spotify. We're on Apple Music.
Your podcast apps.
Your favorite podcast. You can watch us on YouTube, rockchew.com, or your favorite podcast apps. So give us a listen. Follow us on Instagram at rockinchew. And we will see you all next time. Thanks so much for joining us. Had a lot of fun.